This is the Empower Podcast, released May 3rd, 2020. Episode 491, sponsored by Roden Schwartz, the almighty Dollary Do.
Welcome to the Amp Hour. I'm Dave Jones from the EEV blog.
And I'm Chris Gamble of Contextual Electronics.
What's up, nerd?
Hey, man. How's your move going?
How's
your move back to the lab?
Well, it's actually starting to progress now. I did actually move a bench over. So yesterday, I'll get into that. But yesterday was Christmas time for me. Have you ever had one of those days where like everything turns up on the same day? Like a whole bunch of stuff you've ordered?
Yep. Yeah. Like the UPS man shows up with like 20 boxes and you're like, yes,
yeah.
Everything I needed.
Exactly. Yep. Well, yesterday I got new multimeter stock that I've been waiting on.
Okay.
So yep. I got that. So I got like 7 boxes of multimeter.
That's just money. That's just
money. Profit in each meter. It's like bringing a bunch of cash to the door, you know, except I've got to do a lot of work to actually.
Right, of course. Yeah, right.
Ship them. Yeah, right. It'd be much better if I could just get the cash.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I'm just not smart enough businessman to do. I could do that.
I think if people ship you cash too, usually it's pretty shady. You know, it's like boxes of cash showing up at your place. Like,
yeah,
it's usually a money laundering operation.
Right.
There's like a couple TV shows out about that right now. So.
Well, I was eyeing off a local laundromat I could buy or a nail salon.
Oh,
you know,
there we go. That yeah, that's great for laundering money. Yeah.
Yeah,
all right.
It is.
Who needs electronics? You could just, you know. Be in the old cleaning business.
Dave's nail care, yeah.
That's right. Oh, yeah, yeah.
Oh, boy.
So I was wearing nail polish all last week because I think I showed you my thumb got all smashed up. And I was like, well, I might as well just cover this up. It's still pretty ugly, but I was very emo. I had black nail polish on exactly one nail all week. So
nice.
Next time I'll go to Dave, the EEV blog nail salon in order to... to get my nail done.
But I only accept cash, so you know.
Yeah. Oh, right.
yep. And none of that funny money Yankee stuff either.
Got it. Yep. Got to switch to local
Aussie
local
bucks.
Currency.
Aussie dollary dues. Yep. Okay. Thank you very much. Ah, boy. Anyway, so I got my multimeters. Yeah. I got a new game board for my arcade, which I have to install, which is quite exciting. Nice. Because it's a jammer board. If you don't know, jammer's like a standard. It's like an interface connector standard thing. So that in theory, if you've got a jammer arcade console, jammer compatible, you can just plug in any jammer game board. It stands for like Japanese manufacturers, you know, arcade manufacturers association or something like that. And it was a thing back in the 80s, you know, which was the golden era of arcade machines before it all. Totally, the whole industry collapsed.
Well, before it went home, right? Before it went in-house, kind of.
Well, no, the entire industry collapsed. The entire arcade industry, it just totally collapsed. So go look up the golden age of arcades or something, you know, like that. I'm sure it's on
right,
Wiki.
But why did it collapse?
Oh, because it was oversaturated. It was just like there were so many companies entering, trying to capitalize on the new arcade craze that it just absolutely collapsed. I'm sure there's more behind it than that, but you know, the whole thing just went kaput.
God, so, I think it was because, you know, like Atari and Nintendo started popping up, stuff like that. Like,
oh, no, they're the ones who went bust, like, they're the ones who who went tits up. So, yes, anyway, there's documentaries galore on it, I'm sure. Anyway, the jammer, that was the thing. Like, rather than, because there were so many, there were thousands of these different arcade machines, right? So, and the manufacturers didn't want to have to keep designing a different, you know, console and, you know, whole, you know, either a cocktail one, which is the sit-down one, or the upright ones, you know, or the sit-in ones or whatever. They didn't want to have to design a whole new architecture for each new game. So they come up with this jammer system where if you want to change the game, you can just plug in the board. So that in theory, you know, people who owned all these arcades, right, you know, these arcade, you don't remember this, but anyway, there was a local arcade center, right?
Well, I remember I used to go to the arcade, Dave. I mean, this
Right.
I'm not that young, you know.
They
were still around. They just weren't. It wasn't the same like hype culture. That,
right.
You know,
okay.
And now they've resurged as a as barcades now. You know.
Oh, really? Barcade. Okay.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Hmm. Anyway, so rather than the owners of those having to buy new machines, they could simply just get a new like decal thing and then plug in a new Gemma board and they've got a completely new game. So they could like keep their games fresh and keep people coming in and stuff like that. So if the latest game comes out, they can sort of upgrade with these Gemma boards. Anyway, so that was the thing. So yeah, I got a new Gemma board and it's got lots of more goodness on it. So I got that. I got a new prototype multimeter, which I'm looking at selling. So that's exciting.
Okay.
Can never sell too many. You can never have too many multimeters, and you can never sell too many multimeters. So
that's right.
Yeah. So I got a prototype that that's actually interesting because, like, when they first told me about it, it's like, they sent me the specs and everything. I went, it looks okay. You know, send me the prototype as soon as you got it. And it literally is a prototype. There's actually little decal stickers on the front of the range switch to, like, change things because they, So, so it's, like, not finished silk screen or anything yet. So, anyway, so they sent me some initial.
Just trying out the form, not the function.
Out the form factor, form factor and everything else. So, and they sent me some spec, right? And it had a whole bunch of specs. And I went, the specs look pretty good and things like that. And then they finally, just last week, actually, before they sent me the final manual for it with the full manual, which has like all the final specs that they've finally determined. It's interesting how the specs actually change, you know, when you develop a product.
Which direction do they go? Do they go get it better or worse?
Oh, some got better, some got worse. Okay. So, isn't by a huge amount, but the fact that they changed.
Order of magnitude, right?
Right. Oh, well, not even order of magnitude. Or
less than order of magnitude, right?
Oh, we're talking about small changes. Like, you know, from 0.003 to 0.005. Oh, sorry, 0.03 to 0.05, you know, that kind of change.
Yeah.
It's just interesting how they changed. Like, the designers had the idea in mind, right, we're going to try and meet this spec. And then they design their circuit around that. And then once you get all the prototypes back and then you thoroughly test them. And if you don't know, specifying multimeters is like a hard thing because it's not just like you can't just test one prototype and go, oh, yeah, it's within 0.05. Like you've got to test a whole batch of them and figure out the production spread of the specs and all sorts of stuff. It's almost like voodoo black magic kind of, you know.
Actually, I do know. Having worked at the test equipment company.
Keith Lee, of course.
Right.
That's
an interesting point, actually. I think you set the spec up front. I think the difference is probably the reason it changed is like that's just a cost savings measure because Keith Lee days, it was like they set a spec and then they like no matter what, you're gonna go for it, right? You had to get to that point.
You gotta go for it.
If you had to throw more money at components and all this other stuff, and like that is a less great solution for
a price conscious multimeter.
Exactly. Well, and just in general too, I mean, like if you promise an 8.5 digit multimeter, like you're chasing that spec and you have to chase every single, you know, it's like it's asymptotic, right? You have to knock down every single error that's adding to that, right? So I think it's just a cost savings measure on the part of the multimeter that you're working with.
I think it's one of those ones where we're aiming for 0.005%, you know, plus minus two counts, but if it comes out at 0.005% plus four counts, it's like, well, that's what it is. I mean, because these specs, if you don't know, it's like these specs are what they guarantee. So guarantee over temperature range and aging and component spread from the manufacturer and all sorts of stuff. So it's quite difficult. You can't just build a couple and then measure it and set your spec. It's, you know.
Right. Yeah, usually it's like an error budget and then you look at like the, like you're saying, the audit data, and you look at how it's actually doing with multiple units. And by that point you're already pretty darn committed. So
yeah, exactly. And then you'll have historical data to back that up. Like you might have been using the same voltage reference chip for 10 years in 10 different products, right? So you've got really good data on how, on what the spread of that particular temperature reference is, you know? So if you use a new part, yeah, you're effectively starting from scratch. You don't, you have no historical data on that. It's like, right, it's like ironically multimeter calibration, right? If you get your meter calibrated, right, you can send it away. You know, you pay your $100 or your $1,000 for an 8.5-digit meter. You go get it calibrated right, and they send it back. That actually means nothing, right? Because it has some value, but it's not like you cannot, once you get that meter getting back, you can't guarantee that it's still within spec, right? It may have drifted out. It may have, something may have, you know, the vibration on the truck on the way to you may, sure, have done, yep, something to it. Right, you just can't. You just don't know. Traceable calibration is about the history of the instrument. Right, how reliable has this particular instrument been over all these years? And as the years go on, you build up more confidence and more history and more historical data that yes, that particular unit is super stable and it's been transported dozens of times. You know, for traceable testing and calibration and stuff like that. And it's been rock solid, you know, so you build up confidence in that. Basically it's about confidence, measurement confidence. So
I did not know that at all, actually.
Oh, you didn't? What? You come from a test equipment manufacturing. You don't know about measurement confidence. You need to watch my video.
Ask me how many times I ever moved meters, Dave. You know what I mean? Like I wasn't moving them. No, I think that's the thing. And it's like, it's like a metrology thing versus a building them thing. So.
It is a metrology thing, and I've got videos on that. I went to Keysight, and was Agilent at the time, I think. Anyway, So I've got videos of them talking about measurement confidence and traceability and all that sort of jazz, which is really fascinating stuff when you get down to it. So, yep, there you go. So, the specs, the specs changed. It was like, this is kind of the argument I had with David too when we were designing the new micro supply, right? The power supply thing. It's like,
let's say the mythical power, the micro supply.
The mythical power supply, yeah. He's more of the engineer who must have a spec and stick to it. Me, I'm more loosey-goosey. You know, it's like, but we need specs up front and we have to meet them. It needs to be this. And I'm going, it doesn't matter. You know, like it's a power supply. If it comes, if we design it and we build it and we find that because we rolled our own differential amplifier, right? And the differential amplifier with op amps is determined by the feedback resistors, right? So, accuracy of all the matching of matching and accuracy of all the feedback resistors matters, right? So, yeah, and if it comes back and it's like only 0.5% accurate, I don't care that we were targeting 0.25%. If it's 0.5%, mm-hmm, you know, meh, you know, good enough for Australia, right?
Well, I think that's the thing. It's like you didn't want to, like, I think that's really where economics and, you know, like pure engineering, well, not even, it would be more like pure science, right? That's where engineering is, right? It's between the economic balance point of like, we could get to that balance point, but no, why? Like, no one cares. You know? Like,
yeah, exactly. Like, people weren't buying this thing because it was 0.25% accurate. They don't care whether it's 0.25% or 0.5%. They would be buying it because it's novel in some other way, you know, because it's portable and it's, you know, and yeah, they're not buying it based on specs. Whereas if you're buying an 8.5-digit multimeter for $5,000-$10,000, you're buying for specs. You know, totally different classes of.
You could just say it's like based on total price value, like price points, right? It's like less than $500. It's a very different thing than less than $5,000, right?
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah.
Yeah. If my $5,000 scope doesn't work, I'm pissed.
Yeah. What's the old magical consumer, impulse buy price point? Is it still $300? Because it used to be like if a product's under, like if a new Xbox or whatever, PlayStation is under $300, then people will just impulse buy it. Whereas if it's more than that certain limit, people go, oh, I've got to think about, oh, geez, the wife won't be happy if I buy that, you know, and kind of... All that kind of stuff. So
yeah, that's not my price point. I'd say $99 for me.
$99, okay, right.
I mean, a cheapskate here, but like, yeah, I think that's mine. You know, but I think everybody's got something different. You know?
Oh, everyone's got something different. Yeah. It's why I've done videos on the price point of multimeters. I've done like the $50 shootout. I've done the $100 shootout.
Right, exactly.
My 121 GW is in quote marks, a $200 class multimeter. Whereas this new prototype that I got, and I've got an EVBlog forum thread on it, and the EVBlog forum thread is titled the $150 class meter. You know, because where it fits in. Whereas my BM235 is a $100 class meter. It's like
Well, and that's where all the spec comparison is going to come down to, right? Is like
price.
If you're gonna and it's like, you know, if the prototype one you got was fine, you know, it's probably because it's not that much worse than anything else in class, you know.
Oh yeah, of course.
Best in class.
Yeah, exactly. And when people talk about best in class, they're talking about price class usually.
Right, exactly.
Although sometimes you might be talking about, best in 4.5-digit meters, best in 3.5. But really, economics is everything, right? So, usually people are talking about price. So, it's fascinating. So how specs can change and things like that. And it's not always a big deal for those who are for those youngsters out there who are designing things and think they must meet their spec. Not always.
Yep.
Be flexible, because if you've got to spend an extra $10 in BOM cost because you need to meet 0.005 because you set that as your goal and it comes in at 0.007, it's like no, it's not. It may not be worth spending that extra $10 in BOM cost, because that'll blow out your retail price by $25, you know, that 2.5 times multiplier, roughly, rule of thumb.
Sure, yep.
Yeah, you know, the $25 puts you in a different class of instrument and you don't sell as many. It's like, or because you didn't want to budge on your mythical 0.05%.
Yeah, it's crazy. Exactly.
So don't be so stubborn that you.
Well, I think that it like changes your engineering decisions too, right? It's like if you're starting out in like a high, you know, like how about this? When I used to work with people at Keithley and, you know, similar places where like you're designing equipment that has like a certain price expectation and you say make it low cost. It's really, really tough to refactor and rethink all the things that are in there, because it's like, it has to have this and this and this. And it's like, maybe, but you can't. And it just becomes this like this discussion point, or, you know, like it just becomes an expectation difference. I don't know. What was I reading about recently? It was a test where like you give people. Oh, that's what it was. You paid people a small amount to do a task a certain way, to solve a particular problem. It was like, basically, solve a problem. There's like 40 different solutions to solve this problem, right? But as soon as they find one, you pay them a small amount for it. And you say, hey, you can do it as much as you want to. And then, I'm going to butcher this too, I'm sure. And then it was like, and then you bring, so then you say, okay, that experiment's over. You bring the same group back in that you've just paid to do that one thing the same way over and over again. And then you say, all right, now you have to find all 40 ways to do this thing. And they can't do it because they're so hyper-focused on that one thing. Like they're optimizing for that one thing. And whereas if you bring in a fresh group that didn't have that. So like thinking about just like the design. When I was reading it, I was thinking about like the design constraints around like, if you are hyper focused on this, you know, this one segment or this one type of, you know, like in this case, the one type of class of cost meter, it just becomes really hard to break outside of that. You know, maybe it might be easier to go upscale than it is downscale, honestly. Yep. I just think that, you know, like when we've had guests on before that are like toy designers, like Todd Bailey and Jerry Ellsworth, and who else was doing toys? I guess Alicia White has also done toys and stuff like that. They just talk about like these methods where I'm just like, why would you do that? You know?
It's because you just have to do it.
Yeah, exactly. You have to do it. Yeah. And so, it's interesting how that kind of stuff really impacts and how people think about things and solve problems.
Yeah. I've been involved in that where 1 cent mattered. If I could save 1 cent on a part, we were manufacturing 300,000 of these things. 300,000 of these boards. We knew we were going to make we had a contract to make 300,000 of these boards. So if we shave 1 cent off the cost, do the maths. You know, it's like it adds up. Right.
Yep. Totally.
Yeah. Yeah. So I could afford to spend X amount of hours shaving 1 cent off the cost, because, you know, if you're going to save $10,000 on the on the cost, I could literally afford to spend $10,000 in wages in my time to save that 1 cent.
Right, because that's probably calculated over a year of manufacturing, and then you get that paid back. Yep. So it's a 1 year payback period if you spend $10,000 worth of time. Year two, cha-ching, you know, like.
But of course, you can't spend too long because then you have production deadlines.
Right. So this brings me to the what I was kind of leading towards here too is like that kind of that thought pattern of like developing for low cost and maybe high volume and stuff like that. There was an interesting piece that we were going to talk about from Mark Andreessen, who's of Andreessen Horowitz fame. And he, in frustration, it's very obviously in frustration.
He's a venture capitalist for those who don't know. Right. He's a famous VC.
That's right. Andreessen Horowitz is like one of the larger VC firms that's out there. And they've funded many, many of, if you look at their portfolio, it's like a lot of the big winners in the past, I don't know, 20 years. And so he was very frustratedly writing about how we don't build things, in this case, in the US. And it struck me personally because it's someone who made, I snarkily posted
his
about it.
Fortune.
That
he made his fortune
in software. They almost exclusively fund software companies. Why don't we build anything? I was like, oh, I don't know, Mark. Why don't we build anything? And it's like, look, I get that I don't know a lot of what that guy knows. It's fine. But like, you know, Dave and I build hardware. And like the anecdote I gave about it was like, just going from a hardware company to a software company and seeing the margin differences and what is capable of what you can pay for and how you can pay your people and all of the equations change. It's like
totally different ballgame.
Why the hell does anyone build hardware ever? That's what I'm really getting at.
Like, I know.
and this is me working at places that are building high margin hardware, let alone, you know, like working at a factory that's building like PPE, you know, and this is what it's all come down to. Obviously this is a COVID thing, but of course, you know, like there's just, it's a slog. Manufacturing sucks. I've written about that before. It sucks. Yep. It's low margin. It's high demands. You're getting called at 2 a.m, you know, like there are lots of reasons that it hasn't gone that way. I'm not saying it shouldn't be, but like, but damn, like it just felt kind of like, oh, I don't know, colorblind, like tone deaf.
Once people realized, the low overhead in the software business, this is why the dot-com boom happened. This is why dot-com boom and bust happened, because people realize, oh, we can make info. We don't have to produce anything. Software is free. Like, well, back then they were still distributing on CD and stuff like that. But still, your manufacturing cost was virtually nothing, right? It was practically zero, right?
That's right.
And then it became zero once we had the internet and, you know.
Right. Well, and then I think with the internet thing too is this is exactly what VCs talk about. They're like, we want growth. All we care about is growth. And it's like,
growth,
you know what? It's really hard to make a widget and grow that from 1 to 1,000,000. Like that is just, that is a machine that you are starting up to do that. And it's like,
it is not fast, and they want fast.
And they want fast, right? They're going to be funding fast. And it's like, and it becomes a game of that. Okay, fine. You know, and there's some people, like we've had people that fund hardware on the show before, right? Scott Miller is someone who's worked in the VC kind of esque area. We've had, who else did we have on that was a VC? Didn't we have, we had Avidan Ross on as well.
Oh, right. Works
at Root VC as well. We had Christy Meyer, who also works at Root VC. Like they're funding hardware, but they understand a lot of the shit that goes into it, you know,
and how long it takes and how you can.
Yeah, exactly. Know. Right. And it's like, and it's even there, like they talk about like, the growth doesn't come from selling another coffee machine. It comes from selling the pods or the subscription service or the data and all the other crap.
Uh-huh.
Because after reading that, I was just like, you know, okay, would a GE start today? I don't think so. You know, like would a 3M start today? Like, I don't know. Like there's just so much, obviously there's a ton of technology in there, but like the amount of like investment and know-how,
they don't start, like companies like that don't start as with that in mind. They sort of, start out, and over 20, 30 years, they become this huge monolith.
Right.
It's not like somebody's going to have a startup. They're not going to have a startup. Right, we're going to be this huge manufacturing company, and we're going to manufacture, you know, we're going to be dominant in this field. And it's like, and you start from nothing. Nobody thinks like that in the hardware space. Right. It's just, you know, whereas you do in the software space, because you know that, you know, you can do it quickly. All you got to do is hire, you know, a whole bunch of nerdy programmers and pizza and that's it. Right.
Right.
And, well, and throw them at it.
You know, we're going to respond to sweeping generalizations with our own sweeping generalizations, of course. Yeah, but yeah.
Right. But it's not half, you know, it's half true, right? That's like software. You just hire a bunch of nerdy people.
You know
and let
what,
them
Dave?
Go.
It's at least half true. It's at least half true.
Yeah, it's at least, yeah. So, yeah, no, so that's why you'll never see, you know, a company like that, you know, start up.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, they just organically grow over the years. You know, they start up in one niche and then they expand and then they become this big monolith, you know, over 30, 40 years. So, yeah, there you go.
Yeah, I mean, and I think about the, you know, market segments too, right? So, like, so in his screed, he writes about like why aren't we building more things like Elon does? And don't get me started on that guy this week. But but like again, like cars are a much higher. Obviously, there's the transportation cost thing, but there's also the margin. You know, not that cars are super high margin compared to
cars
other things
are a niche,
build.
Right? Once again, this is the classic example. Yeah. Tesla started out; they built a niche car, right? And cars are a niche, like it or not. They're a, you know, the huge industry, but it's still a niche. Like it's one thing, it's one product type, right? And then once that was successful and they had the cash, ooh, I'm really into rockets, or I'm really into solar. I'm going to do, you know, I'm going to invest in a solar company, and then I'm going to start up a, you know, a battery, a storage company, and then I'm going to, because that ties in with my other thing. Sure. It's not like something radically different, you know?
Yeah.
They're all tied in. So...
Yeah, I mean, I wish I had answers on all this stuff. Like, but I think it's like a completely different echelon of like, you're talking about cars and like super highly skilled labor and automation and all that other stuff. And it's like versus cotton swabs. And it's like, yeah, look, there is some cotton swab making that happens in the US, but it becomes like logistical issues. And like, you can throw as much automation as you want at it, but like, I don't know. Like,
it comes down to labor cost in the end, probably. It's like,
well, there's some of that, but then it's also just like, if it's super low margin, like who's going to chase that opportunity, right? I mean, it's just
that low margin. It's a low margin business. Like it's just, there's nothing you can do about it.
And so you need so much volume that like scaling to that point becomes really, really difficult. So I guess there's, you know, different solutions for that that veer into the political, which I don't think we need to discuss here, but like, from that standpoint, maybe there's an argument from the article he's talking about. I mean, some of it was just, it just, like I said, it just read like frustration. And from that, I get it. Everybody's frustrated right now. It sucks.
Has he ever invested in a hardware company?
I think they have. I was looking through their, what do they call it?
Like portfolio.
Yeah. But it was, there was not many of them. So
right. Okay.
Andreessen Horowitz portfolio. And like, and we should say they've been very, very successful.
Oh, of course. Yeah. Oh, but they've had a lot of flops too. You know, they've had a lot of, they've had a handful of big winners. Like, didn't they invest in Google and Facebook?
Well, here we go. Here we go. So this is they put exits up top, right? So exits are the ones where they sell.
Okay. Yeah.
So like, Facebook, Box, Groupon, Lyft.
Yeah. Right.
Pinterest. And these are just the big ones. Zynga, Slack. These Automattic, which is like WordPress. Yeah. Oh God, they're all. They have invested in a lot.
But they're all software.
Local Motion is a, I think that was the car company, although they were a software company.
Mm,
that was doing
hardware.
Onshape, I suppose, is a CAD company.
That's software. Yep.
Yeah, that's the one you use, right?
Yep.
I don't know all these, but, Social Cam, you know, like, again, they're all effectively software companies that are, you know, some of them might have some hardware in there, but I don't see any, do I see any? Nope, that's right. No cotton swab companies.
Right. No mask companies, no, you know, ventilator companies. Yeah, right.
So, yeah.
And you have to remember that, they got those handful of, you know, they got a dozen huge winners. But there's literally thousands they invested in that flopped and lost 100% of their money.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, right. They literally lost 100% of their money on thousands of other investments. It's like that's what they're in it for, is for the couple of big winners, you know.
Oh, totally. Yeah. There's also an article from MIT, which is talking about, so like we've been posting these just because it's been interesting to read other people's takes on this stuff.
Right.
But there is an MIT Technology Review article about it as well that says COVID-19 has blown apart the myth of Silicon Valley innovation. There were some good comments about this in our subreddit. You know, like, yeah, Silicon Valley wasn't really expected in this case. And I get it. But I think it is, if anything, it's just to knock down the like, oh, well, we can do anything with software. And software is eating the world, Mark Andreessen. You know, like, and like, yeah, there are certain things that you just can't get around. And, you know, there are some people that are doing things that are, you know, building up large ventures that are that Elon, I guess, again, is, you know, and other people doing space stuff. Obviously, that's very hardware focused.
Oh, space is big now because it's trendy.
Yeah, right, know. Right. New space. So, new space is a big thing.
When it's trendy, it's easier to get money. That's what I'm
getting. Yeah, I think that's that's a great point. That's
it,
a great point.
It matters. Right? It really matters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yep. Yeah, it's like when Uber became a thing, it was like, yeah, okay, if you're doing an Uber competitor, it's probably very easy to get money, right?
Yeah.
Because it was trendy. People knew, you know, it was the new it thing. So,
Here at the Amp Hour, we focus on learning. We also choose advertisers that have a similar mindset, like Rohde & Schwarz. They have a new product meant for education. The 2000 series oscilloscope is a new entry into the market that bundles features together that normally would be charged per add-on. This means that engineers, or people that are working towards becoming an engineer, get a much higher value for the money they spend. And Rohde & Schwarz doesn't skimp on features. Friend of the show and YouTuber Shahryar from The Signal Path said this about the RTB 2004.
So here I have the output of the generator from the Rohde & Schwarz directly connected to the input of my EXA signal analyzer. And this would allow us to measure the THD performance of the instrument. Now I have set also the Rohde & Schwarz to 25 MHz, which is the highest sinusoid signal it supports. And the amplitude is 500 millivolts peak to peak into 50 ohms. Now we can go ahead and increase the amplitude one step at a time and see how the THD behavior changes. So right now with half a volt peak to peak, the THD is 0.5%, which is minus 46 dBc, which is very, very good. For smaller signals, then the THD is absolutely excellent. So I have no doubt that this would be a useful generator, particularly because we do have the ability of creating arbitrary functions. And for little experiments, projects here and there, this would be very useful.
Shahryar is well known for his interesting experiments, and we always recommend people subscribe to his channel. In this particular video, he demonstrates how the protocol analyzer works on the scope and showcases a problematic serial bus on an Arduino, which he troubleshoots live on screen. Of interest to me in this scope is the web interface that completely replicates the front panel for remote troubleshooting. Check out Shahryar's video for a more in-depth review of the device. And if you want to see other reviews and opinions from fellow engineers, check out askanengineer.us. You can see all the devices that are good value for your bench, which includes other oscilloscopes, signal generators, RF equipment, and more. That's askanengineer.us to find out more about your next piece of test gear. And now, back to the show.
This reminds me of an article many years ago. Well, this was from Robert X. Cringely, one of my favorite bloggers. I think he's almost semi-retired now. Anyway, this was back when Alibaba, right, went public or whatever, and they were worth squillions of dollars. And a lot of people don't know, Yahoo funded Alibaba. Right. So Yahoo, I can't remember what percentage they own, but they own a huge percentage of Alibaba. Right. So Yahoo, of course, has gone the way of the dodo in almost every market segment. You know, they used to be the market darling. Right. Yahoo was the it thing back in the 2000s or something. Right. They, one of the richest companies in the world. And now they're like, nothing really. Who uses Yahoo services, right? No one.
They sold a bunch of their stuff to Verizon and then they got hacked.
Oh, yeah.
Is that what I remember?
Oh, I don't know. But anyway, the reason that they're still going is because they had like $50 billion cash in the bank because they, you know, due to the floating of Alibaba, right? The Yahoo was worth like $50 billion in cash and they had no debt. And he wrote this article about, well, what should they do with this $50 billion in cash? Because they've got, I could be wrong on the figure, but it was enormous like that. And of course, you know, Yahoo's like a dead brand. Like nobody, you know, you couldn't really do that. So he said what they should do is invest literally in every single company, every single startup company that get to the, what was it, round B? What is the, you know, what are the investment rounds?
Yeah,
seed
rounds, pre-seed, seed, series A, series B. Yeah, the series C onward. Yep.
Series B. He said, invest literally in every B round company and you cannot lose because you know, once they get to that point, 20% of them will win, right? Like, you know, it's as they go up in the stages, the odds of them becoming profitable and winning increases, right? When you start at like the angel investing round, like it's like a one chance in a thousand that they'll be successful, right? When you go up to the next, you know, seed level or whatever it is, I'm butchering the terminology. Once you go up to the next level, oh, it's a 1% chance. And then it's a 10% chance. And then it's, so he said, if you invest in every single company in those rounds, like literally everything, it doesn't matter what it is, don't even look at it. Invest in every single company, you're guaranteed to win.
It's like the index fund idea for
it's the index fund idea for corporate investing.
That's a terrible idea. Ugh, I don't like that.
But it would literally work. It's actually guaranteed by the laws of statistics to work.
I mean, that's assuming, okay, sure.
Yeah. Seriously, you can run the numbers on it and it's guaranteed to work. So anyway, that just reminded me of that. I thought it was fascinating. So when you got that much cash to spread around, you know.
Sure. Yeah. Well, we're not there yet, that's for sure.
No, we're not. No, you want your, you know. I get approached by people, oh, do you want to, you know, invest? You know, does the EEV blog want to invest in my, you know, startup and things like that? It's like, well, I'm not that cashed up. Sorry, dude.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Do you take payment in multimeters?
Yeah, right. Yep. Masks, you know.
Right.
I'll take payment. Oh, boy. Nah.
Yeah, I mean, I would love to make manufacturing easier. I mean, like, that's really what it comes down to is, like, manufacturing blows. It's still hard. I don't know. I don't know how to make it any easier, though. Like, I'm still struggling with it. I don't know about you, but, like...
I don't think there's a magic bullet there. A lot of people... Some people have tried. Like, they've tried to make it, you know, they've tried various, you know... techniques to sort of like have everything streamlined and optimized and stuff like that. In our space, like, you know, there's the assemblers who have all the, who have the component libraries, right? It's like you know, their component libraries. And if you use these component libraries, we have these parts in our pick and place machine and you can just press a button and it magically comes to you, you know? And it works in theory, but in practice it never, you know, it never does the business. Modular hardware design is another thing. You know, that was the Altium vision. You know, everything would be modular. Nobody has to design a custom circuit anymore because there'll be, you know, 10 that you'll be able to buy little circuit blocks like on, you know, Mouser and DigiKey. You'll be able to buy these, like, instead of parts, you'll be able to buy these modular circuit blocks. And you just buy the blocks you need, and which come with little PCB layouts, even little, you don't have to lay out boards anymore. They'll actually come, you know, you buy a power supply, it comes with its own little PCB layout, you drop that into your design, and magically all these little blocks, and you finally end up with your finished PCB design, and there's your finished product. Ta-da! Magic, right? And unfortunately, in the real world.
I had to defend myself the other day, actually. So I've been talking about developing a dev board just for something I want to do. And so my partner, Angie, she turns to me and she goes, why don't people just use those? Why do they need people like you? I'm like, oh man, I guess.
Oh, burn.
Yeah. Right. And it's like, well, I mean, it's a good question. I mean, but it's like taken to a smaller and smaller level, right? That's kind of what you're talking about, right? It's like basically a small PCB block is basically a tiny dev board. Right. And it's like, so I think some of the problems are like form factor, right? It's like stacking things. You're still laughing about me getting my,
Getting
asked that, huh? Yeah.
It's great.
But like some of it's form factor, right? Some of it is not being optimized for the situation that you're in, right? And power usage and some more things. And some of it is the cost, right? Adding connectors adds cost. And we were just talking about how expensive it gets when you do that kind of thing. And it's like, so from a prototyping perspective, it almost always makes sense to have some kind of modular thing, right? That's like a Arduino or a Raspberry Pi or anything like that is technically modular because it plugs together with a known header, right? Yep. But is that a good idea for production? Yeah, probably not. Especially when
Depends on your product. If you've got a high value product in a niche market, it doesn't matter that you've got a Raspberry Pi in there.
I just mean that there are other constraints. And like, so you're going to have connectors on your board then to hook things together. And it's like, that's just suboptimal, I think, because you have vibration and you have other.
It might
be the right solution, like you're saying, from a cost perspective, for sure. It is not the best electronics. It might just be the best system design.
Right. Yes. But yeah, it doesn't produce the best finished product, because most finished products have to be like a polished product. It's got to be in a, you know, like a custom designed case. It's, you know, it's got the look and feel is everything. So you can't just, you know, make it a big square project box with a, you know, if you want to enter the professional product market, you know, it can't be just this, you know, big clunky thing. It's got to be custom. And when you go custom design, once you make that decision, okay, I need a custom case. It needs to be this size because it's got to fit in if you want a handheld product. You know, it's not like you can whack a Raspberry Pi board in a handheld product. That's kind of like, you know, it's just not going to work from a physical point of view. So you've got no choice but to bite the bullet and go, well, everything's custom.
Yeah. Yeah, well, yeah, there is always that balance point, right, of like when, what is custom, how,
Yeah. Well, we did that with the micro supply, right? It's like, okay, we wanted this little handheld pocket thing. It's like, well, okay, we have to go to a custom LCD. We have to go to a custom transformer. We have to go to a custom case. We have to go to a custom keypad. We have to go to custom plastic moldings. We have to go, everything has to be custom.
Yeah. Yeah, it kind of makes you wonder, like, it's like a monkey with typewriter kind of thing. It's like, if all the things were out there and if it was a success or an acceptable market solution, right, to like build a thing that was like clunky and plugged together, whatever, and it was like cost-wise, it made sense, like, wouldn't it already be for sale?
Yeah, exactly. That's right. Because it's simple to do. Like,
right, we're not like coming up with like crazy ideas here. You know, it's not like we're like, oh, this is the most innovative thing ever. And it's like, no.
Yep.
Piecing Lego blocks together in different ways, but we're just putting them all the same circuit board, and you know.
Yep. It's fine if you're doing some widget and you're only ever going to sell 10 of them, you know. It's like,
right, exactly.
Yeah, just whack them in a square box, you know, and like,
I think, well, and I think there may be other constraints too, because, you know, I have systems that I've put together that are like that, that are, you know, kind of, I call them Lego block prototypes too, and there are, you know, I make a small dev board that might plug into like a small header board that might plug into like a Adafruit Feather style thing or something like that. But it's like you're saying, it's a, you know, it's low volume. It's not the right solution forever, but it's the right solution for the time. But sometimes there's other design constraints, like, you know, there might be more vibration. There might be, water or like moisture in the system. So you shouldn't have exposed pins and stuff like that. So
that was my life for a decade, you know, was designing production test equipment. Right. And so I'm going to make 10 or 20 of them, you know, like a big thing. Oh, I'm making 20 this time. Oh, wow. You know, I can really spend the engineering on this one. You know, we're making 20 of them. Yay. It's fantastic. Yeah. And then, but no, it still had to be waterproof. You know, it had to be oil proof because it was in a production environment that had oil, you know, that's going to get spilled all over it. And
how do you make it oil? You know? Is it just like potting, or do you do like conformal?
You have to choose the right plastics and stuff that are immune to oil and things like that. You have to choose the right O-rings and other.
Oh, okay. So you're still keeping the board dry, but it's the case.
Dry, yes. It's the case and everything else that goes around it, and the connectors and the wiring and everything else, you know, that has to survive, that kind of stuff. Yeah. So, it comes down to a material science thing.
Yeah.
So yeah,
I've been doing more custom cabling stuff. So I told you about some of my trials and tribulations with custom cabling, and you know, it worked out pretty well. Found a vendor in China that worked out okay. Yep. I got a couple samples in there. They were very responsive, very nice, very easy to deal with. What then popped up was like starting to do like panel mount connectors. I'm sure that's what brought me thinking about it, because you're talking about like water ingress, like IP67 stuff. Like, first off,
panel mount connector.
Holy crap, that gets expensive real fast.
Oh, like, yeah. Yep.
You know, and then it's like, now I'm like, oh, but what if they were custom? You know, like, oh boy.
So, I come from an industry where, you know, $200 US connectors are the norm, right?
Oh, yeah.
Each per unit.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right? It's nothing.
I'm sure I brought it up once, but I actually did, when I used to work in one of my first co-ops, we worked on like military stuff, and the connector was $900.
Yeah.
It was
like
a spec'd by the Navy, you know, like,
oh, yeah. Yes.
You know, the only one company made them. It was like all metal and like had like 80 pins and ridiculousness.
And they're so good quality.
Ah. That one wasn't.
Really?
Oh, it was just, really? You know, it was just, yeah, it was like, I mean, it was good. Yeah. It just wasn't like the best, you know, like, it was like, it was just really custom for what they wanted, you know, and, and it had a spec doc as long as your leg, you know?
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, those were the days. People, yeah, if you haven't worked in those sort of industries, it really is an eye opener when you go work for a military company and you spend 2 weeks specifying a screw, you know, specifying the correct screw. It's like that. Right. That was 2 weeks of your professional life spent specifying a screw.
Yeah.
And yeah, that's the way it is.
It makes you like feel not like an engineer too, because you're like, should I be designing stuff? And it's like, but at the same time, you're getting the job done, right? Which is totally what an engineer has to do. And it's like, but it just feels terrible, you know? It's just like you're having to deal with like purchasing and all the crap that you're swimming through a river of crap. It sucks.
I'm surprised I spent as long there as I did, you know. Anyway,
thing about jobs is they pay you.
And it's comfy, you know, it's cushy. Because they have those lucrative contracts, you know.
So speaking of modular and connectors and stuff like this, I'd seen this bandied about before, and I was always like, what the hell is that thing? But this is the Syzygy. Is that how you say it? Syzygy.
I don't even know if you're speaking English there.
That's right. It's S-Y-Z-Y-G-Y. And I'm sure it's for some terrible, terrible acronym. But basically, it's a standard for pinouts. You know, kind of like PMOD is like a thing for FPGAs, flexible pin header kind of thing for designing add-ons, which is always kind of crazy. So Peter Asdentemsky, we've had on the show a bunch, he did a stream, actually we shared it on the subreddit this week. He was doing a stream where he was making a PMOD that actually hooks into like a Nintendo Super Nintendo controller. Super cool, a lot of fun just to watch that happen, right? But PMODs themselves are so, I don't get it. Like, it's like, it basically is like a, I think it's a 10-pin, I should probably look it up, but it's like a 10-pin connector, and it's like one's power, one's ground, everything else is whatever the hell you want it to be. You know, it's like, basically like, why is this even a standard? You know, it's just like, just tell me where the power and ground is, I guess, you know, but so that's what PMOD is. And that, I think that was Digilint. I know that Digilint sells a lot of stuff with PMOD connectors on it, but because of a lot of FPGA things, you can always, you know, make it super flexible, whatever.
All right.
Syzygy, is now with a transceiver standard. So there's like a standard, there's a transceiver type, there's a, I don't know, there's a bunch of different things. But basically, I've been starting to see these on more dev boards for FPGA things, because it's, again, it's like flexible fabric. You can always route stuff out to it. And then you want to build a transceiver, or do you want to build like a camera board that plugs into a bunch of different dev boards, you can use the standard, I guess.
Yep.
So I've not used it, obviously, because I don't know what I'm talking about. But and also it's a Samtec connector, so it's the 0.5 millimeter pitch connector. So be prepared. I love Samtec. They're a great company, super custom
stuff. Oh, they're great. Yeah, Samtec's the bomb.
Holy crap, they're expensive.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, they're not the cheapest things, but I used to specify Samtec into everything because it was just like the go-to place for like sort of like board to board connectors and things like that.
Yeah. Super low profile. Mm. Like I said,
they got everything.
Great company.
And their sample service was second to none. I don't know if it's still the same now. I've been out of that business for a while now, but their sample service was brilliant. You know, they send you samples for nicks, and that was great.
Right. But you know what? That's what everybody else is paying for.
Exactly. You're paying for it too, because, you know,
that's right.
It's like,
they're getting out of the back end.
They weren't hideously expensive, but then a lot of the Chinese companies would copy. You could get clones of the Samtec connectors, or you could send them their data, or send them the data sheet of the Samtec connector you wanted, and they'd just copy it for you. You know, it's like
guiltily sliding it across the table, that kind of thing.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Can you copy this, please? I don't want to put this US company out of business, but you know, I've got to meet this. My boss is pressuring me to meet this price target, and you know,
Right. Yeah. Well, you talk about another thing that like drives business to like low cost places. It's like, yeah, I mean, everybody's cost conscious. Again, this is going back to the manufacturing conversation. It's like, like if you're judged based on like how much money you can save, you literally have to go. If you were like, no, well, I'm going to just buy the Samtec parts, your boss is gonna be like, no, you're not. And then you say, yes, I am. And then he's going to go, you're fired. Like, that's how it goes.
Right? Exactly. You know? I know. That's how it goes. Yeah.
And so like in a world of just economics, you have to be the lowest cost. And that means that like, well, obviously there's some shady stuff that happens there too, right? Obviously, like, you know,
of course,
it's just copying data sheets.
Oh yeah.
Blah,
and then
blah,
you
blah.
End up with gray market parts and you end up getting bit on the ass because, you know, oh, you left it up to your purchasing department and they ordered these gray market parts, which are either fake or whatever, you know? And it's like, yeah, you've come a gutser. But it sounded good at the time because your purchasing people said, oh yeah, this $1 connector, we found a source for 10 cents. Trust us, you know? And you go, okay. And then it comes back to bite you on the ass.
Send me some samples. And then you have to give a courier number.
Yeah. It's just, oh, geez. Anyway. Yep. Manufacturing. We always end up talking about manufacturing, don't we?
Well, it's kind of a big deal, Dave.
Oh, yeah, I know. It's kind of a big deal, but, you know. Can we get back to my last item on my list yesterday that came in yesterday? Let's talk about what the stuff I got yesterday.
How about stuff? Dave, did you get it for a good price?
Oh, it was pretty reasonable.
See, that's what I'm talking about, you know?
But I didn't care. I would have paid anything for it. I would have paid anything. It didn't matter. Price was no object.
What did you get? Is this the panels?
New LED lighting panels, right? Lighting's important. Yes. Lighting's important in your lab.
I watched the video before. So Dave just put up a video about this. We'll link it.
I just released it before we came on.
I agree that lighting is important in your video, but not from above, Dave. You're going to have cat eyes.
What do you mean cat eyes? Have,
like when you're basically your eyebrows create shadows in your eyes then, you know, like... That's why you need the other fill lights that you're talking about.
Oh, yeah. No, of course. But the bulk of the light that I shoot in comes from my ceiling LED panel lights.
Yeah, I was very impressed with those lights. They look very nice.
Yeah, they're very nice. Anyway, I've been spending like 6 months looking for these bastards.
Right? Oh, wow. Okay.
And yeah, because it is already quite difficult. Go out and try and find a LED ceiling panel light, like in a standard size, like for the drop ceilings, which are either 1200 by 300 millimeters, none of that inches rubbish, or 600 by 600, right? They're standard
really
drop ceiling sizes. Yeah. And right. So try and find one like that. That's actually 5,000 Kelvin color temperature, right? Because all my other lights are 5,000.
Why did you do that? I don't get that.
Well, because my other lights are 5,000K and it's like, and I've always shot in 5,000K, and 5,000K is a videography kind of de facto-y kind of standard, right? Okay. It's kind of, no, if you go to any like photography studio or anything like that, they're using 5,000K, right? Because these are like regular ceiling office panel lights, they don't care about color temperature, right? Yeah, they either come in 4,000 or 6,000.
No, they care about cost, Dave. LED panels. So obviously I bought some LED panels myself, just for general lighting, and like, man, that is a race to the bottom. I actually had I repaired one the other day too.
Oh yeah.
The one that you showed in your video, the aperture, whatever, the, it started with an A.
Oh yeah.
I have the exact same light.
They're not cheap though. They're not cheap.
They're $300, but like, you know, they're pretty, you know, they're like, there isn't a ton of stuff in there, but like, man, it's all the LEDs. Like that's where all the cost is. Like, you know, it's like a array of, I don't know, probably what, 200 by 300 LEDs
something like
or
that.
Something like that. Yeah, it's crazy.
Yep. Oh, totally.
Yeah, probably less than that.
200 by 200.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Anyway. But yeah, no, they're very expensive. And the reason they're expensive is because A, they're the correct color temperature, right? Or in the case of the apertures, they're actually adjustable color temperature. They actually mix different color LEDs in there.
Yeah. But those are super narrow, right?
No. The reason they're expensive is because they're properly binned for CRI or color rendering index, right? That's what you pay top dollar for, is a high CRI light. If you don't know, color rendering index is an index from 0 to 100. In the If you look at the spectrum of the light, you know, the color spectrum with a spectrometer of the light that a LED actually produces, like a cheap ass white LED actually has a very poor color spectrum, whereas an old filament light bulb, right, actually has quite a perfect spectrum, right? I.e., it has all the different colors over the spectrum kind of evenly, and that's what you're aiming for. Mm-hmm. And but whereas cheap white LEDs, they'll peak at certain color temperatures and then they'll have an absence of blue or something. You know, they'll have an absence of all these colors.
Well, you showed like a CFL as like having 50 as a CRI. I thought that was a good example too.
50, that, yeah, like, exactly.
Peaks super hard in greens. Like that's why when you fly over cities, you can always tell who's got a CFL light in their front yard, who's got like an incandescent, who's got LED, because it goes like orange, green, or blue. You know, you can see it as you go by.
Yeah. Because there's an absence of these colors. Because in the case of the fluorescent tube, it's the fluorescent material on the outside coating of the tube that actually fluoresces and actually produces light, and that just produces a poor quality light in terms of the color spectrum. So when you're using it for videography, you're shooting a product, you want that product to show up exactly as it looks to your eyes, right? You want it to have all the colors.
Yeah, best would be like sunlight, right? You're trying to get as close to
sunlight is very good. Yeah, yeah, exactly. Which has the broad spectrum. And anyway, poor quality lights and fluorescent lights, cheap fluorescent. You can get good quality fluorescent lights too, right, with a higher CRI, but you pay more. And so anyway, so not only do I have to have 5,000 Kelvin color temperature, right, so which is already hard enough to get. You can actually buy them. I've bought them before, right? But then you want a high CRI as well. In terms of CRI, anything like 80, your regular LED panels are 80 CRI, right, which is meh. You know, it's missing certain colors or it's very low in certain colors. It's pretty poor. But your good quality ones will have 90 plus, and they're the panels that I got, 90 plus CRI. The those aperture ones you're talking about, the reason they're so expensive because they're 95 plus, right? They're greater than 95. So all those LEDs are individually chosen and binned. Please, if anyone knows from a manufacturing point of view, do they have to manufacture them differently or do they just bin them? I don't know.
I'm sure binning is a huge portion of it, but yeah. They test it and then they say, this is good, this is bad, this is good, this is bad.
That's what we're talking about when we're talking about binning. We're talking about they simply test everyone that comes off the line and all the good ones. It's like Intel manufacturing processes, all the highest spec, they test all the processes and the highest spec ones that pass, they rebrand those as a higher spec unit and sell it for double the price, right? That's just the way it works. So, and what? You're laughing? What?
No, I was just not paying attention, to be honest. Sorry, I was looking at a Twitter post. I'm sorry. I should have been paying attention. Dave, you caught me.
That's right. You caught me. This is like me sleeping. Yeah,
sleeping. This is the closest I'm gonna get to sleeping on a Zoom call. You know, like this is. Sorry, I was looking through Twitter to see what else we should be talking about in the last of the show. I just wanted to make sure we covered everything.
All right.
Then there was shiny lights and.
This was unprofessional podcasting on my part. Oh, I should have let you slide.
I know a lot about CRI. You know, I do some video stuff too. I'm just saying. So I know it now.
And yeah,
so
yeah. All I'm right.
Just teaching the audience.
Yeah, but we're talking to the audience. We're not talking to
each
other.
I know.
Come
I'm
on.
Fine. Yeah. I'm just saying. You know, like, cool if I gap it for a minute.
Anyway,
you know? Like,
all right. 5,000K color temperature, high CRI, and I also wanted low glare, right? For those who don't know, there's this thing called UGR, which is the Unified
Glare
Rating.
Some of this stuff, they just got to go watch the video. I think you're overselling it because it was a good video. Because you're saying all the things you said in the video. You should, you know, save some for the video.
I know, but people don't watch my videos. People just listen to the podcast. They don't even know I have a video channel. You know,
please. It's the other way around and you know
it. Oh, come on. No, anyway, Yuji, come on. For those who couldn't be asked watching my, 10-minute video on LED panels.
All right,
cares,
how about this?
Right?
In depth, usually Amp Hour has the depth of education is what you're trying to say. Is that people here, our listeners,
really
get dialed in. And if you're listening right now, you're better than an EEV blog watcher. You're just an Amp Hour listener.
That's it. You're more educated.
That's right.
Can I explain UGR, please? Unified
UGR,
glare rating.
Go for it. Yes.
UGR, unified glare rating. It's basically how harsh are these things going to be on your eyes? It's like there is a standard for it. There's an international commission on illumination. You know, it sounds like the Illuminati or something,
that's,
right?
That's gonna be a, that's gonna be a wild wild yearly conference. You know,
oh, like, that'd be a that'd be
a bunch of old graybeards sitting around at a bar talking about how the how bad the lighting is in there. You know?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Bitching about the
Well, really, they should use a RN41 on the, you know, that up there is just, you know, that. Let me get out my spectrometer here, you know, double check. There's a color temperature in this bar. It's just,
they didn't account for
great.
The logarithmic. Anyway, the UGR is a complex formula. It's basically 8 log blah blah the sum of the luminance and all sorts of stuff, right? This complex formula. It pops out with a number UGR, and basically anything. You know, like 30 plus would be anything about 30 or above would be like really put like really glary light. You might use them in a, you know, some, you know, hardware store or something like that where you don't really care, you know, something like that, right? Really, or some sort of, you know, like where you just want to deliberately piss people off with how much glary the lights are, you know?
Oh, the DMV where you get your driver's license, you know?
Right. Like that's the, you just want to make people as uncomfortable as possible. Yeah. Right. Like, or some in interrogation room or something, you
that's
know,
right.
you want really glary lights.
That, gotta have that like, you know, sodium halide, like that sound.
Oh boy. Anyway, but anything lower than 19, which is what I got, anything under that is like deemed to be like really low glare panel.
Yeah.
Right. So So I got those were my three requirements that I have, and I finally found a supplier that had all those three. And of course, I bought panels before that I thought were good, and then I test them, and they're like they're advertised at 5,000K, and I measured them, and they're like 6,800K. It's like, you're shitting me. I've been, you know, diddled, right?
I don't have a light meter. I actually did an LED project for a client, and then I had to use their light meter. But, like, is that something that you use often for lighting or other stuff or no?
Oh, yeah. No, you can use your camcorder for this. Any, like, good quality camcorder will actually be able to measure the color temperature for it. So you have a white balance card. Like, I've got one of these professional white balance cards, which is a proper white, you know.
No, I get that. I was talking about the intensity and stuff like that. So like lumens and lux
Yeah, I've got a luminance, you know, that tells me how many lumens. So I put it on the bench and I go, okay, I'm getting 1,000 plus lumens on the bench. If you don't know, anything over 1,000 lumens on a bench is pretty good, right? Anything under, I think the office standard here in Australia, you must have at least 300 lumens on every desk. Otherwise, it doesn't meet the occupational health and safety requirements.
Oh, yeah.
You know, you can like sue your company because they didn't give you enough light or whatever.
Yep. I said, I squint so hard, I pulled something.
Yeah, yeah.
You know.
but for a lab, like I found that I needed 1,000 plus on the bench. So even more than that. So
I just found that like, so I was designing with like, you know, like specs off the data sheet. And, you know, it's like millicandelas per.
Oh, millicandelas are pain.
Milliamps. Or no, it's millicandelas at 20 milliamps. It's like the, at least that's what's on DigiKey.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's just like such a, and then it's like based on like, the distance you're away and like lux versus lumens and like, oh man, there's so many different things.
Oh,
you know?
It's a complex topic. I've got a couple of tutorials with Doug Ford on that. So I might have
I'll have to look that up.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Anyway. Yeah. So the panel, it's a shit business. As you said, it's a race to the bottom who can produce the cheapest panels and they advertise them and they don't even, not even close to meeting their specs, you know, 5,000K in my ass. It's like, it's just because they don't care. You know, they just sell so many millions of these things to government contracts to, you know, we've got government, I don't know if you guys have government incentives to put, you know, they'll come and install, they'll come and replace your compact fluorescent ones with LED panels, higher efficiency LED panels. And all they care about is the efficiency, right? Yeah. They don't care about that they flicker. They don't care that they're the wrong, that a poor color temperature. They don't care about how much glare they have. All they care about, they're more efficient, therefore saving power, therefore good, you know. Right. And the taxpayer's paying for it.
I had ordered a bunch of like, you know, I'm trying to do this on my own. I'm not like government, whatever. We don't have any. I don't know of any system or any programs here. But I like, or you know, just it's smart to order LEDs these days. They'll last longer, whatever. And I ordered some, and I didn't realize the color temperature I bought. I bought 2,700, and I got them back, and I was like, wow, these are like,
really like red, like
orange.
Really,
it's like orange. Yeah.
Orange, yeah. Orange.
And then I, you know, and yeah. then I like just barely touched the dimmer and it just, they started flipping. Uh-huh. I'm like, oh no, these are going back. Because yep. it's the same thing. Yep. I was shopping for price, right? Mm. I bought from God knows where, you know, like it's just super cheap, super low quality, super Amazon.
Yep. That reminds me, before we go, there's a thing which I encountered, which it turns out, as some people pointed me to video, Electro Boom has done a video on this, and someone else has done a video on this. I saw someone else's video on this first. But yeah, these, you know, you buy your regular Edison screwed lead bulbs, right, for that you know, screw into your, you know, ceiling. And like some of them will always stay on. There'll be a dim glow. In them, even when you switch, like you've got a physical switch on your wall and you switch it off, these things continue to glow constantly. And a lot of people say, oh, it's the after it's the residual glow of the fluorescent material in the bulb.
It's actually spooky action at a distance, Dave.
That's spooky action at a distance. Yeah, yes. Yep. Anyway,
it's the spin. It's the spin of the electrons flipping.
It's the cable capacitance, the wiring in your house. If it's, you know, if you've got like really long cable runs and it has to be configured in a certain way, the capacitance of the cable, because you've got AC in your house, right? 50 or 60 hertz for you weird yanks, right?
And not just the yanks, but yeah.
Combined with the capacitance, combined with the low power consumption of these lead bulbs, you know, they can light up with, you know, the sniff of an oily rag, combined with the particular design of the DC to DC converter in them, can lead to some bulbs, actually, even that little sniff of capacitance, they still get enough current, they still get enough turn-on voltage for the DC to DC, and they just light up a little bit.
Yeah, that doesn't make sense to me though, because it's not like a boost topology. Usually, they're like flybacks, usually, aren't they? Like flybacks and bucks.
They're usually like a flyback or a non-isolated, because it's all contained within the bulb.
As you say, usually they're cheap as hell, right?
Yeah, they're cheap as hell, right? So they're like got a, they've just got a, like the really cheap ones will just have a capacitor voltage dropper and a bridge rectifier, and that's it. And then that will go into your constant little 5-pin SOT 23 constant current chip, which then dries the lead. So,
Shenzhen number
four. So any capacitance, So literally that's what's inside those really, you know, compact fluorescent bulbs. They don't have room for a flyback isolation transformer. Why do you need isolation inside a thing which no one can touch, right? Inside, they can't touch the circuitry. Right. So yeah, it's literally open it up and you'll find a capacitor and maybe one diode. Right, because you've got a half wave bridge rectifier, right, and like that's it, and a current regulation chip. So,
wait, how do they actually knock it down though? Don't they need some kind of transformer to knock it down from like 220 where you are?
No, that's what the capacitor's for. So that they'll have an extra series resistor in there. So the 50 hertz of the capacitor has a certain impedance, right? It's a capacitor voltage dropper. So it's basically just a voltage divider. That's it. It's a capacitor resistor voltage divider.
I've never seen it.
Oh, yeah. Open one up. It's a capacitor resistor voltage divider. And it's like, and that's it.
I have gotten burned by boost converters before where I'm like, the whole system's off. Why is that LED still lit? It's like, you know, a little boost converter just like, oh, half a volt? I can do something with that.
Exactly. I've done a video. We'll have to link it in. I thought it was really cool, right?
Was it like a jewel thief or something?
No. I can't remember where I got it. Somebody sent it in the mailbag, I think. It was a lumen counter, right? It was a photon counter, right? Which are these in industrial brick things with a real expensive photo sensor in it, and they count photons. So you'll get like a pulse out. For each
It's like a photo multiplier tube.
And then it's a photo multiplier.
And then it creates like a little cascading effect, right?
Yep. So I figured, I wonder if I can actually, how low a current can I turn down a lead to and can I count the individual photons coming out? And I actually could. I got the graph and it's fascinating. It's fascinating. You know, I think I can't remember the figure, but like the lead was still emitting photons down at, you know, like one microamp or something, and yeah, visible. Right. But it even went down to nanoamps, I think, or something like that, like tens of nanoamps or something. And it was still emitting photons, but you couldn't see them. I think you had to get up to like a couple of microamps before if you got in a dark room, you could actually see the LED and it was lit up, you know, at a couple of microamps. It's just incredible.
Yeah. It's always tough to like try and like teach people who are new to electronics about like LEDs as like a current device.
They're a current device. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, of course. Well, they're a current device, but like maybe showing that like, hey, look, even at these super, super low currents where the voltage is not going to be that much across it and that kind of thing, it's a really hard concept to switch around to. You know what I mean? Like switching from like thinking everything's voltage to, I always tell people like once you start thinking about circuits in terms of current, I think that is just like such an important switch. At least it was for me.
Yep. Oh yeah. It's a big hurdle for a complete beginner who knows nothing about electronics at all. Oh, who's built up a couple of 101 kits and they start teaching you about, you know, like you learn about current, but you don't learn about current driven devices.
Yeah. Well, I think some of the problem as well is from looking at schematics. That is one of the biggest problems, because the mental leap to like see like a ground and like I think like learning current and the importance of current in devices rather would be easier if we didn't use ground symbols. You know what I mean? If we actually had to draw everything. Yeah, because if you're drawing everything going back to the source, you're like, hey, here's the loop. And yeah, I know it's a mess, but we're going to do it anyways.
I'm not sure that makes a huge difference. The difference is in the components themselves. People are, and because the source of power for your product is a battery which has voltage, right? And so people think everything's voltage driven.
Yeah, and
it
needs measurable
volts
to
work, you know.
Yeah,
so that's a big step for going from current voltage driven to current driven devices. But of course, you can't teach a current source to a beginner because they don't work. What's a current source? I can't buy a battery. I can't buy a current source battery, you know, that actually produces 50 milliamps constant. Like you can't buy one, right?
Right.
It's like,
It got really hot. It was really, really warm.
So yeah, that's an interesting hurdle. Yeah. Maybe there's a video in that. Maybe there's a real ultra beginner video in that somehow. The difference between voltage driven versus current.
If you're out there and you're listening to our crazy stuff here and you don't understand it yet, try and think of things in terms of current and it'll help. Let us know in the comments too. That'd be interesting to know.
Not always. Some things aren't current driven devices. LEDs, bipolar transistors are current driven devices, but FETs aren't. FETs.
Yeah, but you could think about it in terms of current driving into like and charging up the gate, and then that develops a field, which I guess is a voltage. Yeah.
I'm starting to twitch, you know. Yeah.
But that's what I'm saying. Like thinking about where the electrons are going, where the current's going, right? Is like, I think that's really important. And then even knowing that, like, so with the FET, right? You have current flowing into a gate, right? It does charge up the gate. That does enable, you know, the field creates current flow from the drain to the source, whatever. Yeah. But I think that's important too, because let me finish. Because the thought then is like, it doesn't get through, right? That is an important thing, right? Understanding that yes, there is current, you need current to drive it up to a certain voltage, but it doesn't actually go through there. I mean, I don't know.
No, because it's a capacitor, and well, unless you're talking about displacement current, let's not go there anyway.
Right.
I've done a video, a trolling video on that. That was fun. Right. Yeah. Anyway, okay. But I would teach, if I was teaching FETs up front, I would say, yeah, look, you feed in 3 volts to the gate or whatever, and it turns on as a switch. You know, I wouldn't teach that, oh, it charges up the capacitance of the gate and it, like, that would be like, yeah, okay, that's how it works at the physics level, but that's not necessarily how I
don't know. It's tough. It's right. Like once you get to a certain point, like my mental model is way different than someone starting electronics. You know what I mean? Like it's just totally different. Like I've been crunching on this stuff for a long time and I think about it different than someone who's getting started.
Oh,
and
absolutely. Yeah.
I'm not even sure if it's right a lot of the time, but I think about it very different.
but it gets the job done, right?
The job done. Yeah, that's right.
Right. That was one of the arguments in my video about does current flow through a capacitor? right? It's like, if you think that it does, you can get the job done, right? The actual electrons, no, they build up on the plate and then they flow back in the other direction and they don't actually go through, you know, the air gap, right? They don't actually go through the air gap. But from a circuit design point of view, it's very convenient to think about current flowing through a capacitor, right?
Yeah,
it's just it's just how, you know, circuit design works. Like, it's just, you know, in a sort of
circuit design in general is just mental models built on top of one another anyways, right? We're just building on top of physics, building on top of whatever.
So anyway, so that was we've completely blown our budget, dude.
We do
try to stick to an hour these days, but you know,
we were feeling it, man. You know, like, that was
We just got carried away. Calm down. Deep breath in, out. Chris. Close out the show.
Okay, let's end today with a little self meditation and thinking about current flow through ourselves.
Kumbaya.
And don't do that, because that's called electrocuting yourself. Don't electrocute yourself. We have a couple more links on the subreddit. People can always submit stuff on the subreddit. You can also comment. There are some really great comments.
We didn't talk about anything on the subreddit, did we?
That's okay.
We didn't get there.
There's some great KiCad plugins that were on there. I've been very excited about KiCad plugins lately. We'll talk about that some other time.
I just want to buy that EMC test chamber. It's $200,000, but God damn it, I want it. I'm doing a GoFundMe.
Oh, I see.
I want it. It's top of the list. It's top of the list.
Oh, this is a tweet. Okay, I see. I didn't see it.
Oh, it's just badass looking. I just want it in the lab because it just looks badass. Imagine having that in your lab.
It looks like, it's like a Stargate for RF. Anyways, we'll leave that as a teaser.
It's like a Stargate for RF. Yep.
We'll leave that as a teaser for all of our listeners.
Or can that be the photo? Can that be the photo? Do we have a photo?
Well,
we
don't
own it, so.
We don't own it, so there's that. You know.
Oh, come on!
We'll share the tweet. How about that? Okay.
Yeah.
Anyways, we'll talk to you next week, Dave. Yeah.
Catch you next time.